This is Talk of the Nation. Neil Conan is off today. I'm John Donvan, on loan from ABC News in Washington. Today, we are going to tackle some truly eternal questions, such as, you know, what hurts more, getting run over by a car or getting stung by a jellyfish? Or, what's inside my eyeballs? And of course, there's, turning up the heat slightly, what does sexy mean? The curious, the profound, and the racy, if you haven't guessed yet, these are questions that children ask. Real kids, real questions, collected now in a real book by journalist Wendell Jamison. The book is called Father Knows Less, or Can I Cook My Sister? One Dad's Quest to Answer His Son's Most Baffling Questions. Wendell also went and he collected answers to the questions from scientists and celebrities and from politicians and from Yoko Ono. But the real question his book raises is, do you always level with curious kids? What if some of them can't handle the truth? Later in the hour, how much is too much when it comes to remembering 9/11? But first, how many hairs do I have on my head, and other questions for Dad? All of you parents, we would love to hear from you about what questions your kids have been asking you and what you are telling them. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Now, Wendell Jamison joins us on the line. He is actually out at sea on board the Queen Mary II sailing off the coast of New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation. And Wendell, I'm told, although I'm a visitor here, that this is an NPR first broadcast conversation from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. What are you doing out there?
Well, we're just taking a weekend trip. My book comes out on Thursday, and if it weren't for my son and his questions, I wouldn't have a book. And where we live in Brooklyn is right near where the Queen Mary docks, and so it's been fertile ground for probably many thousands of questions from him over the years. And so I decided as a treat for the family, we'd take a four-day trip this Labor Day weekend.
Well,
so right now we're about 50 miles south of Nantucket Island, heading back towards New York Harbor.
We started with the question, what hurts more, getting stung by a stingray or being hit by a car? Is that a question from your son, Dean?
That was the first question he asked me that got me thinking that he has sort of an interesting brain. It was several years ago, and I thought it was such a funny question that I sort of wrote it down. Mm-hmm. And I began to write down all of his questions. Am I allergic to metal? What would it feel like to get stabbed? How come in the tub your hands and feet get wrinkly and the rest of you doesn't? I thought when he was a little bit older, 10 years older, 20 years older, I would show him his questions and we would laugh about it. But the more I thought about it, the more fun I thought it would be to get him some answers. And not just sort of answers dumbed down for children, but answers from a real top expert in the field that he was asking me about. So the what would hurt more, getting run over by a car or getting stung by a jellyfish, went to the head of the Division of Pain Management at New York Hospital. And he gave me a very in-depth and fascinating answer to it.
And what's the short version of that answer?
It's the jellyfish. Because it's a fascinating thing, because Dean asked me this question, and I had no idea, but he was sort of asking me about the two types of pain that exist, right? One is somatic pain, which is getting hit by the car because your bones are crushed or your muscles are crushed, and sort of the secondary side effect is that as you feel pain. If you're stung by a very venomous jellyfish, it's a nerve pain, and it's just pain for pain's sake. It's not as though the stinger will pierce your heart and cause it to stop beating. It's simply the pain will be so severe that you go into shock. That's that animal's defense mechanism. So Dean had managed unknowingly to ask me a question about basically the two types of pain a human being can experience.
And did you give it to him straight, or did you just give him the short answer?
I gave it to him straight, and I gave him the short answer.
Okay.
It's the jellyfish. That pretty much was the headline he was looking for. And if when he's older, he can read it and get a more in-depth explanation of that. I think he gets it, though, that the pain from a jellyfish is pain for pain's sake.
Wendell, part of what we're talking about in all of this, how old was Dean, by the way, when he first asked that question?
How old was Dean?
When he asked that question.
I think that was about 3 years ago. I think he was four.
Okay.
And it got me thinking that he has sort of a dark sensibility. And The funny thing that happened was, I collected a few answers for him, and it got me thinking about my own childhood and about the questions that I had asked when I was 4 and 5. And a lot of my book is a memoir of my own childhood, as well as my new experience, relatively new, of being a parent. And I thought back, you know, I was born in 1966, and my early memories are of, you know, the Vietnam War on television and the Watergate hearings. And I thought, how did my parents answer my questions? And I thought about a time we were driving down the highway on the Long Island Expressway when I must have been 5 years old. And this was, of course, before we had air conditioning. And, well, we didn't in our car. Maybe other people did in their cars. We had a Volkswagen station wagon. All the windows were open. There was a lot of wind blowing around back there. It was very hot, and it was incredibly noisy. And I remember asking my dad, you know, why is the highway so noisy? And without missing a beat, he said, it's because people on both sides of the highway have their vacuum cleaners on. That became kind of a staple of my childhood. My parents would sort of give me funny, made-up answers to questions.
But did you buy it?
And as a parent, you know, it's a funny thing. I sort of did and didn't at the same time. I accepted it. I sat back. It was, you know, maybe 20 years later, I was driving down the highway. I'm like, wait a minute, what was he talking about? So you sort of accept it without examining it too closely.
So what's the real answer?
Excuse me?
What is the real answer to why the noise, highway is so noisy?
Well, it's a lot of things. It's the wind, and it's the cars around you, but it's mostly the sound of the tires on the asphalt. Huh. And I got my answer for the book. Hang on one quick second. Let me just find it. From Jeffrey Patterson, who's a motion picture sound mixer, including Twister, which I thought would be the appropriate movie, because there's tons and tons of wind sound in that. 75% of the sound that I heard was the tire hitting the asphalt. And he pointed out that a lot of municipalities have begun to put old tires, ground old tires, into their asphalt, which really cuts down the sound quite a bit.
All right, we've got a lot of listeners already with questions that I think they want to put to you, potentially as the guru. But I first want to bring in Mara from Tucson, Arizona. Mara, you're on Talk of the Nation. Welcome. What would you like to ask Wendell?
Hi, thanks. Well, it's not so much a question. It's a statement that my daughter made many years ago. After my dad passed away, she was around 5. And after a few days after the funeral, she came kind of storming down the stairs, and she said to me, "Mommy, why are we born if we're just going to die anyway?"
Oh my gosh! And so you were there on the spot, needing to come up with an answer. How did you do?
Well, I thought about it for a little bit. I said, I need to think about it. So, and then a little bit later, I said, "Well, this is what I've come up with." I said, "It's what we do in between." It's what we do, you know, what we do in between being born and dying. It's really what's important.
Mm-hmm. What do you think she was looking for?
Well, I think she was looking for trying to understand about death. And, you know, I went into a discussion and we had talked about, you know, she had seen we had lost animals and, you know, and talked about the leaves and the trees and autumn and things like that. And I think it's what children really think about. They really have a depth of awareness that, you know, we adults struggle with and trying to put it behind us as if it doesn't exist.
Thanks, Mara, for that call, because it raises a really interesting point. I know that in the book, death, disease, dying, et cetera, sickness is really a lot of, it's a whole chapter for you, basically, Wendell. And as we said in the beginning, what if they can't handle the truth? How much do you feel you owe it to tell your kids the real truth, and how much do you need to edit?
Well, the mission of this book was to get the true answer. I found in many cases, if you get the true answer, it almost demystifies the horror of what the answer might be. Now, about half this book, as I said, is a memoir, and I do talk about Dean when he started asking me about death and what happens. And it's sort of a slippery slope when you begin the conversation, right? He says, you know, "Daddy, am I going to die?" And I say, "Oh, you know, well, everybody does die, but don't worry, it'll be a long, long time in the future. I'll die before you will." Well, oops. "What do you mean you're going to die? When are you going to die?" Mm. "Well, no. I'm not going to die anytime soon." The way I dealt with it with him was I wanted to show him how much time was ahead of him before he'd really have to confront his own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather, his great-grandfather, was 95, was still alive, and I was able to say, "Look, you know, Pop-Up is alive. He was born when there was just maybe one or two airplanes, and there were still horses going down the street, and there was no television, God forbid, and no internet."
But there was radio.
Imagine how much the world will be changed by the time you've grown to that age. Mm-hmm. And I think that calmed him down. Then, unfortunately, my grandfather did die shortly after I had that conversation with him. But he was took it pretty well, and we went to the funeral, and he seemed, you know, to sort of grasp that it's a long time before he really has to confront that, and a long time before I have to confront that. Knock on wood.
All right.
Right now.
We're going to bring in Cleveland, Ohio, and Mark. Hello, Mark. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Here, listen. Turn up the radio. Hi. Hello?
Hi.
This is Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. You know what? I realized when I was very, very young, now I'm 54 now, and as I reflect back on my life, I realized that at quite a young age that many adults were lying to me a high percentage of the time, and it has affected my entire philosophy and worldview towards everything.
What were they lying about? I'm assuming it's not just Santa Claus.
Well, the first thing was God.
The first thing was what?
God. The existence of God.
Which way did they go on that?
Well, most of the people on the planet believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, you know, my father said that he was an agnostic. I knew my grandmother very well, and she was very religious, and she was the granddaughter of an escaped slave, and faith was a big part of her life. And I told my father that I was an atheist, and he said, "Oh no, you're an agnostic." And at a very young age, I was adamant. Agnostic was, you know, much too. In the middle for me.
Mark, we're coming up to a break. I'm going to carry over where I think you're going with this after the break and talk a little bit with Wendell about that point in religion. We're talking about some of the tough questions kids ask, like, what will they talk about next on Talk of the Nation? But I just told you that. We'll have an answer and take more of your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can also email us. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm John Donvan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan in Washington, and Neil Conan is off today. And we've been talking about some of the questions that kids ask their parents when younger, but sometimes it's the answers the parents come up with that are just as or possibly more interesting, the ever and eternal question of where do babies come from. But we were a minute ago talking about the question of God, which also goes to the question of heaven and where do we go when we die. And Wendell, I think the gentleman who was on before, I think he was telling us that he was an atheist and people were telling him that there was a God and that there was a heaven. And it goes to the broader question of, as you were talking about with your son about his grandfather, wanting to give kids an answer that you're torn between wanting to give them what you actually believe and sometimes giving them the answer that you feel will make them feel good, feel better, feel reassured. How do you navigate between those two choices?
Well, first of all, you know, the God question was interesting. I did not get into religion in this book. I looked for questions from children that were rooted in sort of the known world, not the theoretical world, that I could actually run down real concrete answers to, not just sort of opinions or thoughts. Many people gave me questions like, is God a girl or a boy? And things like that. And I just sort of stayed away from that because there's so many interpretations, so many faiths, that it would just, you know, it would go on and on. I think if you always give the true answer and watch how you couch it, in the long run, that's going to be the best scenario. Certainly, I've hesitated myself to give true, hard answers. And certainly in the case of my grandfather, I tried to couch it in the most comforting way. But I didn't say he just goes to sleep and he goes to a better place. I don't know that. So I just told my son what I knew. If there was some short-term pain in that, I think in the long run, if he knows he's always getting the truth from me, I think that's probably the best way to navigate this particular tricky wicket. It certainly is.
Beth in Tallahassee, Florida, you're joining us on Talk of the Nation. Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to share my favorite question that my son asked me one day. We were driving through town, and he had been sitting quietly next to me. He looked up and said, "Mom, if you and Dad die, who's going to teach me to drive?" And I enjoyed that quite a bit. And I told him I was sure his uncles would be happy to do that.
I'm sorry, you broke up there for a second. In fact, you've all been breaking up just a little bit. What was the question again? Who's going to teach
you
to drive?
I'm sorry. Yes, he said, who would teach me to drive? Can you hear me?
Yeah. So, Beth, how did you take that? Did you take that as a question about death or as a question about driver's ed?
Oh, it was about being, you know, this is very important to learn to drive. He didn't care about the death part.
He was
very worried.
That's a funny outlook on it, and sort of the strange side effect of all the things he'll have to do on his own.
Well, Beth, thank you for the memory. But I wanted to ask you, Wendell, how much of what we really are talking about here is how we feel as parents, in that they're looking to us parents. I'm a parent as well. They're looking to us to kind of know everything, and I personally find that a humbling feeling, particularly the majority of times I don't know the answer to the question.
Of course.
And you too had to go looking.
Yes, I went looking, and in every answer in my book, I learned something. You know, I didn't know the answer to one of these questions. I have a great question. Does Mona Lisa wear shoes? Here's a little kid. He sees a poster for the Da Vinci Code. And that's the question, literally asking out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. I found a medieval footwear expert and reenactor who was able to explain to me that the Mona Lisa was painted at precisely the time that medieval Europe was switching over from old-fashioned, what they call turn shoes, sort of more like leather slippers, to what's essentially the modern shoe that we wear today. I had no idea, just like Dean and the somatic versus neuropathic pain, I had no idea that this question would take me back to a fault line in footwear history. I just go and get the answers if I don't know, and so many I don't know. And I've given up with Dean. He's getting worse and worse. He's asking more and more questions. I've almost just given up, and I just write them down, and I figure if I ever have a moment, I'll nail them for him.
Yeah.
But it's a roadmap for you on how he's learning the world. At least
he's
asking.
What I'm hearing here and what I'm hearing there are not the same.
Daniel Sam, I think you're talking to us live on the air. Yeah. Daniel Sam is another listener who's just popped up.
Daniel Sam.
Hi, how are you? I'm John Donvan, and you're on with Wendell, and you're calling in from Sebastopol, California. Tell us about yourself, what you want to ask us.
Okay, Daniel Sam. Go ahead.
What?
Tell me your question.
Okay. Here's my question.
Okay.
Does space go on forever?
Does space go on forever?
And if not...
Go on forever?
And if not, where does it end?
Where do you bump your head? All right. Daniel, Sam, and Mom, thank you for the call. We're going to give that to you off air. And I also want to bring in the host of Science Friday, Ira Flatow, who's at home in Connecticut but is taking a little bit of break from Labor Day to join us. And you're very good at these kinds of questions, Ira. So can you help Daniel Sam out with welcome to the show, first of
thank
all.
Thank you.
And can you help Daniel Sam out? I feel like it's Dr. Seuss' name.
You know,
Daniel Sam, I am.
This is one of the oldest questions ever asked about space. Einstein was asked this question way back in the 30s. He used to write about it. They would phrase it a little different way. They'd say, what would happen if you got to the edge of the universe? Could you poke your thumb through it?
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to explain that our concept of how big space is not the physics concept of time and size. You'd have to say that there is space, does end, but it's sort of infinite. You know, it's sort of an oxymoron to try to explain it.
I don't think Daniel Sam's going to do well with the word oxymoron.
Well, okay, I'll try to explain it this way. Space does have an ending to it, but we don't know where it ends. We think we know that space is what we would say is 14 billion years old. So the light has been traveling, let's say, for 14 billion years. That's about how big it is. And a light year is 6 trillion miles. So it's a very, very, very big place. But scientists, when they talk about space, they say that it does have an ending to it, but we will never get there. Let's put it that way.
All right. Let's go to another caller. Vanessa in Atlanta.
I like that question.
It's a great question.
Well, so many of the questions that I have deal with space. That seems such a natural, fertile ground mm-hmm. for imaginative questions, and also a tough one because there's so much we don't know about it. So those were always very challenging to me, and a lot of questions I asked when I was little in the late 60s and early 70s when you were seeing the last moonshots also focused on space and other planets. It's a bottomless well of questions, and it's endlessly fascinating for children and grown-up children.
Vanessa in Atlanta, Georgia, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's been so much fun. I've got two kids, and on the one hand, I've really enjoyed realizing how much I do know. I didn't know that I knew all what I know, but it's amazing how many times I will, somewhere from the depth of me, be able to explain what lightning is, whereas, you know, who knew I knew that? But there was one question that I think has really stumped me was from my daughter, which was, what is purple plus 9?
But of course.
Of course.
Ira.
Was it again?
And there's got to be. I mean, you figure, you know, color is light. It's. I'm sure there's some mathematical breakdown to purple. There probably somewhere is an answer to purple plus 9. My favorite, though, was from my son, who was about 3.5 at the time that his little sister was born. And his question was, can we send Viva's poopy diapers to George Bush? He absolutely thought it was a great idea to send poop-filled baby diapers to the White House.
How old was he at the time he developed?
He was 3.5.
A little touch of satire, 3.5?
3.5, yeah. Get him young.
I think that this would be something George Bush would be happy to receive.
I gave him an emphatic yes, but wasn't quite sure how that would play out under the Patriot Act.
All right, Vanessa, I want to...
Lots of cable TV?
We have no television.
Oh.
Vanessa, thanks very much for calling in. Ira, I don't know if I want to put you on the spot with what's purple plus 9. You have any thoughts on that?
I have never heard of that, but, you know, I have three kids, and they ask me stuff, and I remember asking my father very embarrassing questions that he was not afraid to answer, you know? And I never heard of that question, no.
We'd like to bring in...
About George Bush and the poopy diapers, you mean?
No,
purple plus 9.
No, purple 9. Sorry, you're breaking up here out at sea, so excuse me if I'm a little out of it sometimes.
That you're doing fine. I want to go to San Mateo, California, and Rommel, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I'm sorry, a little bit nervous. The question that my daughter asked me once was how to make ice. I explained to her you make ice by reducing the temperature. But then she asked me, how do you reduce the temperature every single day to make ice? And I cannot be able to answer that question somehow.
How do you reduce the temperature every single day to make ice? Do you mean how do you make ice if you don't have ice?
Exactly.
Make ice in the freezer.
Yeah.
How does the freezer get cold?
Basically, I think that's the question.
Well, that's explainable.
See, now...
Okay, somebody take
what
it.
What I tried to do in my book was find someone who lived the answer. There's some where I would go to a scientist or someone like that, but more often than not, I wanted someone whose life experience answered the question. So I have an astronaut who answers, how far will my balloon go up before it pops? I have Yoko Ono answers, why did the Beatles break up? So I'm trying to think, I guess for the ice question, I might find like a bartender or someone whose very livelihood depends on ice.
Well, I can offer another question of a question, a solution. And, you know, I love it when people ask questions, and I think sometimes a solution is another question. And this question would be, why is it that when you spray deodorant or you hold a spray can and you hit the nozzle on the spray can, it's cold when it comes out? That's the answer to how you make ice. If you put something under pressure in a pressurized can, like a spray can, you press the nozzle, you decompress what's inside, and when you decompress it, the stuff that comes out is colder. So in the refrigerator, what they're doing is basically making a big spray can and spraying it inside the freezer, and you have cold air.
Ira, we have an email from Pat Gigerich in Ventnor, New Jersey, who's quoting a son or daughter, it's unclear, "Mommy, does dust have little dusts? In other words, is there dust on dust?"
Sure. Depends, you know, how big is the dust?
Where does it stop?
There could be big dust and little dust. Mm-hmm. Dust can be on dust. no reason why not. If you know.
Well, now we've gone from the universe to the biggest thing we can imagine to certainly one of the smallest. Dean is now obsessed with the atom and its tininess and how many atoms are in my pinky and things like that. So children definitely focus on these incredible extremes.
The good news is when he gets to quantum mechanics, it'll all be so spooky that it'll be hard to believe it's any of it's true.
Well, Ira, I'm going to...
I can't quite see him at the quantum stage yet. I imagine it'll happen sooner or later.
Ira, I'm going to let you get back to your vacation, and thanks so much for joining us and you're going to work on Purple Plus 9 for us.
I will. Thank you. Good luck, and have a good vacation yourself, hopefully.
All right. Thanks
have
a lot.
Holiday.
We want to go to Milton, Oregon, and Marcy, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. When my daughter was born, my son was about 2.5, and he says, Mama, when the baby was born, your legs braked off? And I tried real hard not to laugh, and then I said, well, that's what it felt like. I think he said that because of the pictures I had showed him, you know, that are in magazines and stuff, of, you know, that shows a woman, but it doesn't show her legs. It just shows, you know, the uterus and the baby inside and everything.
Right. Waist up. Well, Marcy, thanks for your point, and it raises another thing I wanted to get to with Wendell, which is the whole, as we said in the beginning, one of the really challenging questions for a lot of parents is where do babies come from, and its many variants.
That's right. Well, like death, birth is something they're very fascinated by. And my wife, by the way, said it felt like being turned inside out, not having her leg ripped off. And we did have the conversation, where do babies come from, or how did Dean... We were sort of vague about how he got in his mother's stomach, but I do recount in the book how we explained to him how he got out. And he, of course, was pretty shocked where he came from. He was there, you know, he saw his sister when she was just a day old, and she was certainly not 2 inches tall. She was, you know, a full-sized baby. So he was amazed how the mother is able to get that baby into the world. I've subsequently had to have the conversation with him about how he got in there in the first place, and that was he was pretty amazed and shocked and perhaps even disgusted by that process.
We've had an emailer trying to help us answer Purple Plus 9 from Renee in Chico, California. Just FYI, there is a number table applied to colors. The intensity is measured by a number system. A color theorist could actually calculate the Purple Plus 9 and probably come up with a number plus a corresponding color. So there you go. That question potentially didn't come out of
there. There you have it.
Stephanie Wagner wrote in an email saying, when I was young, my parents were very open about the processes of death, believing facts were less scary than imagination. One day during preschool, I found a dead and frozen cat in the yard and decided to bring it back to life. I did so by putting it on the radio in the cloakroom. When the fur began to singe and the teacher found it, she knew who did it and asked why. My answer was that the cat was in rigid mortar and that if I softened her up, she would be alive again. So... I don't know what that tells us, Wendell, except maybe sometimes kids can take the answers and go off into a whole different realms with them. You have to be very clear about the way...
Or they're satisfied with the answer and they move on to their next topic. When Dean and I were having this conversation just the other day, I said, you know, do you know how the baby gets in there? And he sort of looked at me and I said, you know, if your friends ever talked about something called sex? And he said, well, we know it's something disgusting. I said, well, I'm not sure it is. He said, is it kissing? I said, well. He said, is it kissing naked? I said, well, you're getting closer.
So what's going to happen as Dean gets older? Do you expect the questions get tougher, or do you think that ultimately they're going to taper off as you become embarrassing to him and he wants to spend less time to you? Do you think that he's going to go somewhere else for all the answers?
He's got to give up on me sooner or later. I mean, I'm batting at least, you know, less than 500 right now on all the questions that come out of him. I'm batting 1,000 on those that I take months to find someone to answer. But there's so many more questions. I would think he would have given up some time ago, but there are more and more coming out every day. Why do we have hair? He asked me the other day, when the queen goes to dinner, who plays the check? Begging for mercy at this point.
Well, I say enjoy this period of time in your life when you're still the answer man. I want to thanks very much for joining us, Wendell Jameson, from aboard the Queen Mary II, sailing off the Atlantic off New York. He's the author of Father Knows Less, or Can I Cook My Sister? Thanks very much for joining us. Coming up, remembering 9/11, can tributes ever go too far? When is enough enough? The number is 800-989-8255 or email at talk@npr.org. I'm John Donvan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.